If Richard personified the family's dark, fanatical side, Gottfried embodied the indolent one. When he reached the age of 18, I decided to take him under my wing. He was my dead brother's son, after all. And you have to remember that the age difference between Gottfried and me was not so great. I was only 7 years older, but by then I was on the firm's board, and it was clear that I was the one who would take over from my father, while Gottfried was more or less regarded as an outsider.
Wanger thought for a moment.
My father didn't really know how to deal with his grandson, so I was the one who gave him a job in the company. This was after the war. He did try to do a reasonable job, but he was lazy. He was a charmer and good time Charlie. He had a way with women, and there were periods when he drank too much. It isn't easy to describe my feelings for him. He wasn't a good-for-nothing, but he was not the least bit reliable, and he often disappointed me deeply. Over the years he turned into an alcoholic, and in 1965 he died, the victim of an accidental drowning. That happened at the other end of Hedeby Island, where he'd had a cabin built and where he used to hide away to drink.
"So he's the father of Harriet and Martin," Blomqvist said, pointing at the portrait on the coffee table. Reluctantly, he had to admit that the old man's story was intriguing.
"Correct. In the late 40s, Gottfried met a German woman by the name of Isabella Koenig, who had come to Sweden after the war. She was quite a beauty. I mean that she had a lovely radiance like Garbo or Ingrid Bergman. Harriet probably got more of her genes from her mother rather than from Gottfried. As you can see from the photograph, she was pretty even at 14.
Blomqvist and Wanger contemplated the picture.
"But let me continue. Isabella was born in 1928 and is still alive. She was 11 when the war began, and you can imagine what it was like to be a teenager in Berlin during the aerial bombardments. It must have felt as if she had arrived in paradise on Earth when she landed in Sweden. Regrettably, she shared many of Gottfried's vices. She was lazy and partied incessantly. She travelled a great deal in Sweden and abroad and lacked all sense of responsibility. Obviously, this affected the children. Martin was born in 1948 and Harriet in 1950. Their childhood was chaotic, with a mother who was forever leaving them and a father who was virtually an alcoholic. In 1958, I'd had enough and decided to try to break the vicious cycle. At the time, Gottfried and Isabella were living in Hedestad. I insisted that they move out here. Martin and Harriet were more or less left to fend for themselves."
Wanger glanced at the clock.
"My 30 minutes are almost up, but I'm close to the end of the story. Will you give me a reprieve?"
"Go on," Blomqvist said.
"In short, then, I was childless, in striking contrast to my brothers and other family members who seemed obsessed with the need to propagate the House of Wanger. Gottfried and Isabella did move here, but their marriage was on the rocks. After only a year, Gottfried moved out to his cabin. He lived there alone for long periods and went back to Isabella when it got too cold. I took care of Martin and Harriet, and they became, in many ways, the children I never had. Martin was... To tell the truth, there was a time in his youth when I was afraid he was going to follow in his father's footsteps. He was weak and introverted and melancholy, but he could also be delightful and enthusiastic. He had some troubled years in his teens, but he straightened himself out when he started at the university. He is, well, in spite of everything, he is CEO of what's left of Wanger Corporation, which I suppose is to his credit.
And Harriet?
Harriet was the apple of my eye. I tried to give her a sense of security and develop her self-confidence, and we took a liking to each other. I looked on her as my own daughter, and she ended up being closer to me than to her parents. You see, Harriet was very special. She was introverted, like her brother, and as a teenager she became wrapped up in religion, unlike anyone else in the family. But she had a clear talent, and she was tremendously intelligent. She had both morals and backbone. When she was 14 or 15, I was convinced that she was the one, and not her brother or any of the mediocre cousins, nephews, and nieces around me, who was destined to run the Wanger business one day, or at least play a central role in it.
So what happened?
Now we come to the real reason I want to hire you. I want you to find out who in the family murdered Harriet, and who since then has spent almost 40 years trying to drive me insane.
Chapter 5. Thursday, December 26th. For the first time since he began his monologue, the old man had managed to take Blomqvist by surprise. He had asked him to repeat it to be sure he had heard correctly. Nothing in the cuttings had hinted at a murder.
It was September 24th, 1966. Harriet was 16 and had just begun her second year at prep school. It was a Saturday and it turned into the worst day of my life. I've gone over the events so many times that I think I can account for what happened in every minute of that day, except the most important thing.
He made a sweeping gesture.
Here in this house a great number of my family had gathered. It was the loathsome annual dinner. It was a tradition which my father's father introduced, and which generally turned into pretty detestable affairs. The tradition came to an end in the '80s, when Martin simply decreed that all discussions about the business would take place at regular board meetings and by voting. That's the best decision he ever made.
You said that Harriet was murdered.
Wait, let me tell you what happened. It was a Saturday, as I said. It was also the day of the party, with the Children's Day parade that was arranged by the sports club in Hedestad. Harriet had gone into the town during the day and watched the parade with some of her school friends. She came back here to Hedeby Island just after 2 PM. Dinner was supposed to begin at 5, and she was expected to take part along with the other young people in the family.
Wanger got up and went over to the window. He motioned Blomqvist to join him and pointed.
At 2:15, a few minutes after Harriet came home, a dramatic accident occurred out there on the bridge. A man called Gustav Aronsson, a brother of a farmer at Ostergården, a small holding on Hedeby Island, turned onto the bridge and crashed head-on with an oil truck. Evidently, both were going too fast, and what should have been a minor collision proved a catastrophe. The driver of the truck, presumably instinctively, turned his wheel away from the car, hit the railing of the bridge, and the tanker flipped over. It ended up across the bridge with its trailer hanging over the edge. One of the railings had been driven into the oil tank, and flammable heating oil began spurting out. In the meantime, Aronsson sat pinned inside his car, screaming in pain. The tanker driver was also injured, but managed to scramble out of his cabin.
The old man went back to his chair.
The accident actually had nothing to do with Harriet, but it was significant in a crucial way. A shambles ensued. People on both sides of the bridge hurried to try to help. The risk of fire was significant, and a major alarm was sounded. Police officers, an ambulance, the rescue squad, the fire brigade, reporters and sightseers arrived in rapid succession. Naturally, all of them assembled on the mainland side. Here on the island side, we did what we could to get Aronsson out of the wreck, which proved to be damnably difficult. He was pinned in and seriously injured. We tried to prise him loose with our bare hands, and that didn't work. He would have to be cut or sawed out, but we couldn't do anything that risked striking a spark. We were standing in the middle of a sea of oil next to a tanker truck lying on its side. If it had exploded, we would have all been killed. It took a long time before we could get help from the mainland side. The truck was wedged right across the bridge, and climbing over it would have been the same as climbing over a bomb.
Blomqvist could not resist the feeling that the old man was telling a meticulously rehearsed story, deliberately to capture his interest. The man was an excellent storyteller, no question. On the other hand, where was the story heading?
What matters about the accident is that the bridge was blocked for 24 hours. Not until Sunday evening was the last of the oil pumped out, and then the truck could be lifted up by crane and the bridge opened for traffic. During these 24 hours, Hedeby Island was, to all intents and purposes, cut off from the rest of the world. The only way to get across to the mainland was on a fireboat that was brought in to transport people from the small boat harbour on this side to the old harbour below the church. For several hours the boat was used only by rescue crews. It wasn't until quite late on Saturday night that stranded islanders began to be ferried across. Do you understand the significance of this?
I assume that something happened to Harriet here on the island, Blomqvist said, and that the list of suspects consists of the finite number of people trapped here. A sort of locked room mystery in island format? Wanger smiled ironically.
Mikhail, you don't know how right you are. Even I have read my Dorothy Sayers. These are the facts. Harriet arrived here on the island about 2:10. If we also include children and unmarried guests, all in all about 40 family members arrived in the course of the day. Along with servants and residents, there were 64 people either here or near the farm. Some of them, the ones who were going to spend the night, were busy getting settled in neighbouring farms or in guest rooms. Harriet had previously lived in a house across the road, but given that neither Gottfried nor Isabella was consistently stable, and one could clearly see how that upset the girl, undermined her studies and so on, in 1964, when she was 14, I arranged for her to move into my house. Isabella probably thought that it was just fine to be spared the responsibility for her daughter. Harriet had been living here for the past 2 years, so this is where she came that day. We know that she met and exchanged words with Harold in the courtyard. He's one of my older brothers. Then she came up the stairs to this room and said hello to me. She said that she wanted to talk to me about something. Right then I had some other family members with me, and I couldn't spare the time for her, but she seemed anxious, and I promised I'd come to her room when I was free. She left through that door, and that was the last time I saw her. A minute or so later there was the crash on the bridge, and the bedlam that followed upset all our plans for the day.
How did she die?
It's more complicated than that, and I have to tell the story in chronological order. When the accident occurred, people dropped whatever they were doing and ran to the scene. I suppose I took charge and was feverishly occupied for the next few hours. Harriet came down to the bridge right away. Several people saw her. But the danger of an explosion made me instruct anyone who wasn't involved in getting Aronson out of his car to stay well back. 5 of us remained. There were myself and my brother Harold. There was a man named Magnus Nielsen, one of my workers. There was a sawmill worker named Sixten Nordlander, who had a house down by the fishing harbour, and there was a fellow named Jerke Aronson. He was only 16, and I should really have sent him away, but he was the nephew of Gustav in the car. At about 2:40, Harriet was in the kitchen here in the house. She drank a glass of milk and talked briefly to Astrid, our cook. They looked out of the window at the commotion down at the bridge. At 2:55, Harriet crossed the courtyard. She was seen by Isabella. About a minute later she ran into Otto Falk, the pastor in Hedeby. At that time the parsonage was where Martin Wanger has his villa today, and the pastor lived on this side of the bridge. He had been in bed nursing a cold when the accident took place. He had missed the drama, but someone had telephoned, and he was on his way to the bridge. Harriet stopped him on the road and apparently wanted to say something to him, but he waved her off and hurried past. Falk was the last person to see her alive.
How did she die? Blomqvist said again.
I don't know,
Wanger said with a troubled expression.
We didn't get Aronson out of his car until around 5. He survived, by the way, although he was not in good shape, and sometime after 6 the threat of fire was considered past. The island was still cut off, but things began to calm down. It wasn't until we sat down at the table to have our long-delayed dinner around 8 that we discovered Harriet was missing. I sent one of the cousins to get Harriet from her room, but she came back to say that she couldn't find her. I didn't think much about it. I probably assumed she had gone for a walk, or she hadn't been told that dinner was served. And during the evening I had to deal with various discussions and arguments with the family. So it wasn't until the next morning, when Isabella went to find her, that we realized that nobody knew where Harriet was, and that no one had seen her since the day before.
He spread his arms out wide.
And from that day, she has been missing without a trace.
Missing? Blomqvist echoed.
For all these years we haven't been able to find one microscopic scrap of her.
But if she vanished, as you say, you can't be sure that she was murdered.
I understand the objection. I've had thoughts along the same lines. When a person vanishes without a trace, one of 4 things could have happened. She could have gone off of her own free will and be hiding somewhere. She could have had an accident and died. She could have committed suicide. And finally, she could have been the victim of a crime. I've weighed all these possibilities.
But you believe that someone took Harriet's life?
Why? Because it's the only reasonable conclusion.
Vanger held up one finger.
From the outset, I hoped that she had run away. But as the days passed, we all realized that this wasn't the case. I mean, how would a 16-year-old from such a protected world, even a very able girl, be able to manage on her own? How could she stay hidden without being discovered? Where would she get money? And even if she got a job somewhere, she would need a social security card and an address.
He held up two fingers.
My next thought was that she had had some kind of accident. Can you do me a favour? Go to the desk and open the top drawer. There's a map there.
Blomqvist did as he was asked, and unfolded the map on the coffee table. Hedeby Island was an irregularly shaped land mass about 2 miles long, with a maximum width of about 1 mile. A large part of the island was covered by forest. There was a built-up area by the bridge and around the little summer house harbour. On the other side of the island was the small holding, Ustergården, from which the unfortunate Aronson had started out in his car.
"Remember that she couldn't have left the island," Vanger said. "Here on Hedeby Island you could die in an accident just like anywhere else. You could be struck by lightning, but there was no thunderstorm that day. You could be trampled to death by a horse, fall down a well, or tumble into a rock crevice. There are no doubt hundreds of ways to fall victim to an accident here. I've thought of most of them."
He held up three fingers.
"There's just one catch, and this also applies to the third possibility, that the girl, contrary to every indication, took her own life. Her body must be somewhere in this limited area."
Vanger slammed his fist down on the map.
"In the days after she disappeared, we searched everywhere, crisscrossing the island. The men waded through every ditch, scarred every patch of field, cliff, and uprooted tree. We went through every building, chimney, well, barn, and hidden garret."
The old man looked away from Blomqvist and stared into the darkness outside the window. His voice grew lower and more intimate.
"The whole autumn I looked for her, even after the search parties stopped and people had given up. When I wasn't tending to my work, I began going for walks, back and forth, across the island. Winter came on and we still hadn't found a trace of her. In the spring I kept on looking until I realized how preposterous my search was. When summer came, I hired 3 experienced woodsmen who did the entire search over again, with dogs. They combed every square foot of the island. By that time I had begun to think that someone must have killed her, so they also searched for a grave. They worked at it for 3 months. We found not the slightest vestige of the girl. It was as if she had dissolved into thin air."
"I can think of a number of possibilities," Blomqvist ventured.
"Let's hear them."
"She could have drowned, accidentally or on purpose. This is an island and water can hide most things."
"True, but the probability isn't great. Consider the following. If Harriet met with an accident and drowned, logically it must have occurred somewhere in the immediate vicinity of the village. Remember that the excitement on the bridge was the most sensational thing that had happened here on Hedeby Island in several decades. It was not a time when a 16-year-old girl with a normal sense of curiosity would decide to go for a walk to the other side of the island. But, more important," he said, "there's not much of a current here, and the winds at that time of year were out of the north or northeast. If anything falls into the water, it comes up somewhere along the beach on the mainland, and over there it's built up almost everywhere. Don't think that we didn't consider this. We dragged almost all the spots where she could conceivably have gone down to the water. I also hired young men from a scuba diving club here in Hedestad. They spent the rest of the season combing the bottom of the sound and along the beaches. I'm convinced she's not in the water. If she had been, we would have found her."
"But could she not have met with an accident somewhere else? The bridge was blocked, of course, but it's a short distance over to the mainland. She could have swum or rowed across."
"It was late September, and the water was so cold that Harriet would hardly have set off to go swimming in the midst of all the commotion. But if she suddenly got the idea to swim to the mainland, she would have been seen and drawn a lot of attention. There were dozens of eyes on the bridge, and on the mainland side there were 200 or 300 people along the water watching the scene."
"A rowing boat?"
"No, That day there were precisely 13 boats on Haydeby Island. Most of the pleasure boats were already in storage on land. Down in the small boat harbour by the summer cabins there were 2 Pettersen boats in the water. There were 7 Ecker rowing boats, of which 5 were pulled up on shore. Below the parsonage 1 rowing boat was on shore and 1 in the water. By Ustergården there was a rowing boat and a motor boat. All these boats were checked and were exactly where they were supposed to be. If she had rowed across and run away, she would have had to leave the boat on the other side.
Vanger held up 4 fingers.
So there's only 1 reasonable possibility left, namely that Harriet disappeared against her will. Someone killed her and got rid of the body.
Lisbeth Salander spent Christmas morning reading Mikael Blomqvist's controversial book about financial journalism, The Knights Templar, A Cautionary Tale for Financial Reporters. The cover had a trendy design by Christer Malm featuring a photograph of the Stockholm Stock Exchange. Malm had worked in Photoshop, and it took a moment to notice that the building was floating in air. It was a dramatic cover with which to set the tone for what was to come. Salander could see that Blomqvist was a fine writer. The book was set out in a straightforward and engaging way, and even people with no insight into the labyrinth of financial journalism could learn something from reading it. The tone was sharp and sarcastic. But above all, it was persuasive. The first chapter was a sort of declaration of war, in which Blomqvist did not mince words. In the last 20 years, Swedish financial journalists had developed into a group of incompetent lackeys who were puffed up with self-importance and who had no record of thinking critically. He drew this conclusion because time after time, without the least objection, so many financial reporters seemed content to regurgitate the statements issued by CEOs and stock market speculators, even when this information was plainly misleading or wrong. These reporters were thus either so naive and gullible that they ought to be packed off to other assignments, or they were people who quite consciously betrayed their journalistic function. Blomqvist claimed that he had often been ashamed to be called a financial reporter. Since then he would risk being lumped together with people whom he did not rate as reporters at all. He compared the efforts of financial journalists with the way crime reporters or foreign correspondents worked. He painted a picture of the outcry that would result if a legal correspondent began uncritically reproducing the prosecutor's case as gospel in a murder trial, without consulting the defence arguments or interviewing the victim's family before forming an opinion of what was likely or unlikely. According to Blomqvist, the same rules had to apply to financial journalists. The rest of the book consisted of a chain of evidence to support his case. One long chapter examined the reporting of a famous dot-com in 6 daily papers, as well as in the financial journal Dagens Industri and A Ekonomi, the business report on Swedish TV. He first quoted and summarized what the reporters had said and written. Then he made a comparison with the actual situation. In describing the development of the company, he listed time after time the simple questions that a serious reporter would have asked, but which the whole corps of financial reporters had neglected to ask. It was a neat move. Another chapter dealt with the IPO of Telia stock. It was the book's most jocular and ironic section, in which some financial writers were castigated by name, including one William Borg, to whom Blomqvist seemed to be particularly hostile. A chapter near the end of the book compared the level of competence of Swedish and foreign financial reporters. He described how serious reporters at London's Financial Times, The Economist, and some German financial papers had reported similar subjects in their own countries. The comparison was not favourable to the Swedish journalists. The final chapter contained a sketch with suggestions as to how this deplorable situation could be remedied. The conclusion of the book echoed the introduction. If a parliamentary reporter handled his assignment by uncritically taking up a lance in support of every decision that was pushed through, no matter how preposterous, or if a political reporter were to show a similar lack of judgment, that reporter would be fired, or at the least reassigned to a department where he or she could not do so much damage. In the world of financial reporting, however, the normal journalistic mandate to undertake critical investigations and objectively report findings to the readers appears not to apply. Instead, the most successful rogue is applauded. In this way, the future of Sweden is also being created, and all remaining trust in journalists as a core of professionals is being compromised. Salander had no difficulty understanding the agitated debate that had followed in the trade publication, The Journalist, certain financial newspapers, and on the front pages, and in the business sections of the daily papers. Even though only a few reporters were mentioned by name in the book, Salander guessed that the field was small enough that everyone would know exactly which individuals were being referred to when various newspapers were quoted. Blomqvist had made himself some bitter enemies, which was also reflected in the malicious comments to the court in the Wennerström affair. She closed the book and looked at the photograph on the back. Blomqvist's dark blonde shock of hair fell a bit carelessly across his forehead, as if caught in a gust of wind. Or, and this was more plausible, as if Krister Malm had posed him. He was looking into the camera with an ironic smile and an expression perhaps aiming to be charming and boyish. A very good-looking man, on his way to do 3 months in the slammer. "Hello, Callie Blomqvist," she said to herself. "You're pretty pleased with yourself, aren't you?" At lunchtime, Salander booted up her iBook and opened Eudora to write an email. She typed, "Have you got time?" She signed it WASP and sent it to the address plague_xyz_666@hotmail.com. To be on the safe side, she ran the message through her PGP encryption program. Then she put on black jeans, heavy winter boots, a warm polo shirt, a dark pea jacket, and matching knitted gloves, cap, and scarf. She took the rings out of her eyebrows and nostril, put on a pale pink lipstick, and examined herself in the bathroom mirror. She looked like any other woman out for a weekend stroll, and she regarded her outfit as appropriate camouflage for an expedition behind enemy lines. She took the tunnelbana from Zinkensdamm to Östermalmstorg and walked down towards Strandvägen. She sauntered along the central reserve, reading the numbers on the buildings. She had almost got to Djurgårds Bridge when she stopped and looked at the door she had been searching for. She crossed the street and waited a few feet from the street door. She noticed that most people who were out walking in the cold weather on the day after Christmas were walking along the quay. Only a few were on the pavement side. She had to wait for almost half an hour before an old woman with a cane approached from the direction of Djurgården. The woman stopped and studied Salander with suspicion. Salander gave her a friendly smile in return. The lady with the cane returned her greeting and looked as though she were trying to remember when she had last seen the young woman. Salander turned her back and took a few steps away from the door, as though she were impatiently waiting for someone, pacing back and forth. When she turned, the lady had reached the door and was slowly putting in a number on the code lock. Salander had no difficulty seeing that the combination was 1260. She waited 5 minutes more before she went to the door. She punched in the code, and the lock clicked. She peered into the stairwell. There was a security camera which she glanced at and ignored. It was a model that Milton Security carried and was activated only if an alarm for a break-in or an attack was sounded on the property. Farther in, to the left of an antique lift cage, there was a door with another code lock. She tried 1260, and it worked for the entrance to the cellar level and rubbish room. Sloppy, very sloppy. She spent 3 minutes investigating the cellar level, where she located an unlocked laundry room and a recycling room. Then she used a set of pick locks that she had borrowed from Milton's locksmith to open a locked door to what seemed to be a meeting room for the condominium association. At the back of the cellar was a hobby room. Finally, she found what she was looking for, the building's small electrical room. She examined the meters, fuse boxes, and junction boxes, and then took out a Canon digital camera the size of a cigarette packet. She took 3 pictures. On the way out, she cast her eye down the list of residents by the lift and read the name for the apartment on the top floor, Wennerström. Then she left the building and walked rapidly to the National Museum, where she went into the cafeteria to have some coffee and warm up. After about half an hour, she made her way back to Söder and went up to her apartment. There was an answer from plague_xyz_666@hotmail.com. When she decoded it in PGP, it read 20. Chapter 6. Thursday, December 26th. The time limit set by Blomqvist had been exceeded by a good margin. It was 4:30, and there was no hope of catching the afternoon train, but he still had a chance of making the evening train at 9:30. He stood by the window, rubbing his neck as he stared out at the illuminated façade of the church on the other side of the bridge. Wanger had shown him a scrapbook with articles from both the local newspaper and the national media. There had been quite a bit of media interest for a while. Girl from noted industrialist's family disappears. But when no body was found, and there was no breakthrough in the investigation, interest gradually waned. Despite the fact that a prominent family was involved, 36 years later the case of Harriet Wanger was all but forgotten. The prevailing theory in articles from the late '60s seemed to be that she drowned and was swept out to sea. A tragedy, but something that could happen to any family. Blomqvist had been fascinated by the old man's account, but when Wanger excused himself to go to the bathroom, his scepticism returned. The old man had still not got to the end, and Blomqvist had finally promised to listen to the whole story.
"What do you think happened to her?" he said when Wanger came back into the room.
"Normally, there were some 25 people living here year-round, but because of the family gathering, there were more than 60 on Hedeby Island that day. Of these, between 20 and 25 can be ruled out, pretty much so. I believe that of those remaining, someone, and in all likelihood it was someone from the family, killed Harriet and hid the body."
"I have a dozen objections to that."
"Let's hear them."
"Well, the first one is that even if someone hid her body, it should have been found if the search was as thorough as the one you described."
"To tell you the truth, the search was even more extensive than I've described. It wasn't until I began to think of Harriet as a murder victim that I realized several ways in which her body could have disappeared. I can't prove this, but it's at least within the realm of possibility."
"Tell me."
"Harriet went missing sometime around 3 that afternoon. At about 2:55, she was seen by Pastor Falk, who was hurrying to the bridge. At almost exactly the same time, a photographer arrived from the local paper, and for the next hour he took a great number of pictures of the drama. The police, I mean, examined the photographs and confirmed that Harriet was not in any one of them. But every other person in town was seen in at least one, apart from very small children."
Wanger took out another album and placed it on the table.
"These are pictures from that day. The first one was taken in Hedestad during the Children's Day Parade. The same photographer took it around 1:15 p.m. and Harriet is there in it."
The photograph was taken from the second floor of a building and showed a street along which the parade, clowns on trucks and girls in bathing suits, had just passed. Spectators thronged the pavements. Wanger pointed out a figure in the crowd.
"That's Harriet. It's about 2 hours before she will disappear. She's with some of her school friends in town. This is the last picture taken of her. But there's one more interesting shot."
Wanger leafed through the pages. The album contained about 180 pictures, 5 rolls, from the crash on the bridge. After having heard the account, it was almost too much to suddenly see it in the form of sharp black-and-white images. The photographer was a professional who had managed to capture the turmoil surrounding the accident. A large number of the pictures focused on the activities around the overturned tanker truck. Blomqvist had no problem identifying a gesticulating, much younger Henrik Wanger, soaked with heating oil.
"This is my brother Harold."
The old man pointed to a man in shirt sleeves bending forward and pointing at something inside the wreck of Aronson's car.
"My brother Harold may be an unpleasant person, but I think he can be eliminated from the list of suspects. Except for a very short while, when he had to run back here to the farm to change his shoes, he spent the afternoon on the bridge."
Wanger turned some more pages. One image followed another. Focus on the tanker truck. Focus on spectators on the foreshore. Focus on Aronson's car. General views. Close-ups with a telephoto lens.
"This is the interesting picture," Wanger said. "As far as we could determine, it was taken between 3:40 and 3:45, or about 45 minutes after Harriet ran into Falk. Take a look at the house. The middle second-floor window, that's Harriet's room. In the preceding picture, the window was closed. Here, it's open."
"Someone must have been in Harriet's room."
"I asked everyone. nobody would admit to opening the window.
Which means that either Harriet did it herself, and she was still alive at that point, or else that someone was lying to you. But why would a murderer go into her room and open the window? And why should anyone lie about it? Wanger shook his head. No explanation presented itself.
Harriet disappeared sometime around 3 or shortly thereafter. These pictures give an impression of where certain people were at that time. That's why I can eliminate a number of people from the list of suspects. For the same reason, I can conclude that some people who are not in the photographs at that time must be added to the list of suspects.
You didn't answer my question about how you think the body was removed. I realize, of course, that there must be some plausible explanation, some sort of common old illusionist's trick.
There are actually several very practical ways it could have been done. Sometime around 3, the killer struck. He or she presumably didn't use any sort of weapon, or we would have found traces of blood. I'm guessing that Harriet was strangled, and I'm guessing that it happened here, behind the wall in the courtyard, somewhere out of the photographer's line of sight, and in a blind spot from the house. There's a path, if you want to take a shortcut, to the parsonage, the last place she was seen, and back to the house. Today there's a small flower bed and lawn there, but in the 60s it was a gravelled area used for parking. All the killer had to do was open the boot of a car and put Harriet inside. When we began searching the island the next day, nobody was thinking that a crime had been committed. We focused on the shorelines, the buildings, and the woods closest to the village.
So nobody was checking the boots of cars.
And by the following evening, the killer would have been free to get in his car and drive across the bridge to hide the body somewhere else.
Right under the noses of everyone involved in the search. If that's the way it happened, we're talking about a cold-blooded bastard. Wanger gave a bitter laugh.
You just gave an apt description of quite a few members of the Wanger family.
They continued their discussion over supper at 6. Anna served roast hare with currant jelly and potatoes. Wanger poured a robust red wine. Blomqvist still had plenty of time to make the last train. He thought it was about time to sum things up.
It's a fascinating story you've been telling me, I admit it. But I still don't know why you wanted me to hear it.
I told you. I want to nail the swine who murdered Harriet, and I want to hire you to find out who it was.
Why? Wanger put down his knife and fork.
Mikhail, for 36 years I've driven myself crazy wondering what happened to Harriet. I've devoted more and more of my time to it.
He fell silent and took off his glasses, scrutinizing some invisible speck of dirt on the lens. Then he raised his eyes and looked at Blomqvist.
To be completely honest with you, Harriet's disappearance was the reason why gradually I withdrew from the firm's management. I lost all motivation. I knew that there was a killer somewhere nearby, and the worrying and searching for the truth began to affect my work. The worst thing is that the burden didn't get any lighter over time. On the contrary. Around 1970, I had a period when I just wanted to be left alone. Then Martin joined the board of directors, and he had to take on more and more of my work. In 1976 I retired, and Martin took over as CEO. I still have a seat on the board, but I haven't sailed many knots since I turned 50. For the last 36 years, not a day has passed that I have not pondered Harriet's disappearance. You may think I'm obsessed with it. At least most of my relatives think so.
It was a horrific event.
More than that. It ruined my life. That's something I've become more aware of as time has passed. Do you have a good sense of yourself?
I think so, yes.
I do too. I can't forget what happened, but my motives have changed over the years. At first it was probably grief. I wanted to find her and at least have a chance to bury her. It was about getting justice for Harriet.
In what way has that changed?
Now it's more about finding the bastard who did it. But the funny thing is, the older I get, the more of an all-absorbing hobby it has become.
Hobby?
Yes, I would use that word. When the police investigation petered out, I kept going. I've tried to proceed systematically and scientifically. I've gathered all the information that could possibly be found, the photographs, the police report. I've written down everything people told me about what they were doing that day. So, in effect, I've spent almost half my life collecting information about a single day.
You realize, I suppose,
that after 36 years the killer himself might be dead and buried?
I don't believe that.
Blomqvist raised his eyebrows at the conviction in his voice.
Let's finish dinner and go back upstairs. There's one more detail before my story is done, and it's the most perplexing of all.
Salander parked the Corolla with the automatic transmission by the commuter railway station in Sundbyberg. She had borrowed the Toyota from Milton Securities Motor Pool. She had not exactly asked permission, but Armansky had never expressly forbidden her from using Milton's cars. Sooner or later, she thought, I have to get a vehicle of my own. She did own a second-hand Kawasaki 125, which she used in the summertime. During the winter, the bike was locked in her cellar. She walked to Höglinkavägen and rang the bell at 6 on the dot. Seconds later, the lock on the street door clicked and she went up 2 flights and rang the doorbell next to the name of Svensson. She had no idea who Svensson might be, or if any such person even lived in that apartment.
"Hi, Plague," she said.
"Wasp.
You only pop in when you need something."
As usual, it was dark in the apartment. The light from a single lamp seeped out into the hall from the bedroom he used as an office. The man, who was 3 years older than Salander, was 6'2" and weighed 330 pounds. She herself was 4'11" and weighed 90 pounds, and had always felt like a midget next to Plague. The place smelled stuffy and stale.
"It's because you never take a bath, Plague. It smells like a monkey house in here. If you ever went out, I could give you some tips on soap. They have it at the Consum."
He gave her a wan smile, but said nothing. He motioned her to follow him into the kitchen. He plopped down on a chair by the kitchen table without turning on a light. The only illumination came from the street light beyond the window.
"I mean, I may not hold the record in cleaning house either, but if I've got old milk cartons that smell like maggots, I bundle them up and put them out."
"I'm on a disability pension," he said. "I'm socially incompetent."
"So that's why the government gave you a place to live and forgot about you. Aren't you ever afraid that your neighbours are going to complain to the inspectors? Then you might fetch up in the funny farm."
"Have you something for me?"
Salander unzipped her jacket pocket and handed him 5,000 kroner.
"It's all I can spare. It's my own money, and I can't really deduct you as a dependent."
"What do you want?"
"The electronic cuff you talked about 2 months ago. Did you get it?"
He smiled and laid a box on the table.
"Show me how it works."
For the next few minutes, she listened intently. Then she tested the cuff. Plague might be a social incompetent, but he was unquestionably a genius. Wanger waited until he once more had Blomqvist's attention. Blomqvist looked at his watch and said,
"One perplexing detail."
Wanger said,
"I was born on November the 1st. When Harriet was 8, she gave me a birthday present. A pressed flower, framed."
Wanger walked around the desk and pointed to the first flower, Bluebell. It had an amateurish mounting.
"This was the first. I got it in 1958.
He pointed to the next one.
1959.
Buttercup.
1960.
Daisy.
It became a tradition. She would make the frame sometime during the summer and save it until my birthday. I always hung them on the wall in this room. In 1966 she disappeared, and the tradition was broken."
Wanger pointed to a gap in the row of frames. Blomqvist felt the hairs rise on the back of his neck. The wall was filled with pressed flowers.
1967, a year after she disappeared, I received this flower on my birthday. It's a violet."
"How did the flower come to you?"
"Wrapped in what they call gift paper and posted in a padded envelope from Stockholm. No return address, no message."
"You mean that..." Blomqvist made a sweeping gesture.
"Precisely. On my birthday every damn year. Do you know how that feels? It's directed at me, precisely as if the murderer wants to torture me. I've worried myself sick over whether Harriet might have been taken away because someone wanted to get at me. It was no secret that she and I had a special relationship and that I thought of her as my own daughter."
"So what is it you want me to do?" Blomqvist said.
When Salander returned the Corolla to the garage under Milton's security, she made sure to go to the toilet upstairs in the office. She used her card key in the door and took the lift straight up to the third floor to avoid going in through the main entrance on the second floor where the duty officer worked. She used the toilet and got a cup of coffee from the espresso machine that Armansky had bought, when at long last he recognized that Salander would never make coffee just because it was expected of her. Then she went to her office and hung her leather jacket over the back of her chair. The office was a 6.5 by 10 foot glass cubicle. There was a desk with an old model Dell desktop PC, a telephone, one office chair, a metal waste paper basket, and a bookshelf. The bookshelf contained an assortment of directories and 3 blank notebooks. The 2 desk drawers housed some ballpoints, paper clips, and a notebook. On the windowsill stood a potted plant with brown, withered leaves. Salander looked thoughtfully at the plant as if it were the first time she had seen it. Then she deposited it firmly in the waste paper basket. She seldom had anything to do in her office and visited it no more than 6 times a year, mainly when she needed to sit by herself and prepare a report just before handing it in. Armansky had insisted that she have her own space. His reasoning was that she would then feel like part of the company, although she worked as a freelancer. She suspected that Armansky hoped that this way he would have a chance to keep an eye on her and meddle in her affairs. At first, she had been given space farther down the corridor in a larger room that she was expected to share with a colleague, but since she was never there, Armansky finally moved her into the cubbyhole at the end of the corridor. Salander took out the cuff. She looked at it, meditatively biting her lower lip. It was 11:00 and she was alone on the floor. She suddenly felt excruciatingly bored. After a while, she got up and walked to the end of the hall and tried the door to Armansky's office. Locked. She looked around. The chances of anyone turning up in the corridor around midnight on December 26th were almost non-existent. She opened the door with a pirate copy of the company's card key, which she had taken the trouble to make several years before. Armansky's office was spacious. In front of his desk were guest chairs and a conference table with room for 8 people was in the corner. It was impeccably neat. She had not snooped in his office for quite some time, but now that she was here, she spent a while at his desk to bring herself up to date regarding the search for a suspected mole in the company, which of her colleagues had been planted undercover in a firm where a theft ring was operating, and what measures had been taken in all secrecy to protect a client who was afraid her child was in danger of being kidnapped by the father. At last, she put the papers back precisely the way they were, locked Armansky's door, and walked home. She felt satisfied with her day.
I don't know whether we'll find out the truth, but I refuse to go to my grave without giving it one last try, the old man said. I simply want to commission you to go through all the evidence one last time.
This is crazy, Blomqvist said.
Why is it crazy?
I've heard enough. Henrik, I understand your grief, but I have to be honest with you. What you're asking me to do is a waste of my time and your money. You are asking me to conjure up a solution to a mystery that the police and experienced investigators with considerably greater resources have failed to solve all these years. You're asking me to solve a crime getting on for 40 years after it was committed. How could I possibly do that?
We haven't discussed your fee,
Wanger said.
That won't be necessary.
I can't force you, but listen to what I'm offering. Froda has already drawn up a contract. We can negotiate the details, but the contract is simple and all it needs is your signature.
Henrik, this is absurd. I really don't believe I can solve the mystery of Harriet's disappearance.
According to the contract, you don't have to. All it asks is that you do your best. If you fail, then it's God's will, or, if you don't believe in him, it's fate.
Blomqvist sighed. He was feeling more and more uncomfortable and wanted to end this visit to Hedeby, but he relented.
All right. Let's hear it.
I want you to live and work here in Hedeby for 1 year. I want you to go through the investigative report on Harriet's disappearance 1 page at a time. I want you to examine everything with new eyes. I want you to question all the old conclusions exactly the way an investigative reporter would. I want you to look for something that I and the police and other investigators may have missed.
You're asking me to set aside my life and career, to devote myself for 1 year to something that's a complete waste of time.
Wanger smiled.
As to your career, we might agree that for the moment it's somewhat on hold.
Blomqvist had no answer to that.
I want to buy a year of your life, give you a job. The salary is better than any offer you will ever get in your life. I will pay you 200,000 kroner a month. That's 2.4 million kroner, if you accept and stay the whole year.
Blomqvist was astonished.
I have no illusions. The possibility you will succeed is minimal. But if, against all odds, you should crack the mystery, then I'm offering a bonus of double payment, or 4.8 million kroner. Let's be generous and round it off to 5 million.
Vanger leaned back and cocked his head.
I can pay the money into any bank account you wish anywhere in the world. You can also take the money in cash in a suitcase, so it's up to you whether you want to report the income to the tax authorities.
This is not healthy, Blomqvist stammered.
Why so?
Vanger said calmly.
I'm 82 and still in full possession of my faculties. I have a large personal fortune. I can spend it any way I want. I have no children and absolutely no desire to leave any money to relatives I despise. I've made my last will and testament. I'll be giving the bulk of my fortune to the World Wildlife Fund. A few people who are close to me will receive significant amounts, including Anna.
Blomqvist shook his head.
Try to understand me, Vanger said. I'm a man who's going to die soon. There's one thing in the world I want to have, and that's an answer to this question that has plagued me for half my life. I don't expect to find the answer, but I do have resources to make one last attempt. Is that unreasonable? I owe it to Harriet, and I owe it to myself.
You'll be paying me several million kroner for nothing. All I need to do is sign the contract and then twiddle my thumbs for a year.
You wouldn't do that. On the contrary, you'll work harder than you've ever worked in your life.
How can you be so sure?
Because I can offer you something that you can't buy for any price, but which you want more than anything in the world.
And what would that be?
Vanger's eyes narrowed.
I can give you Hans Erik Wennerström. I can prove that he's a swindler. He happened 35 years ago to begin his career with me, and I can give you his head on a platter. Solve the mystery, and you can turn your defeat in court into the story of the year.
Chapter 7. Friday, January 3rd.
Erika set her coffee cup on the table and stood by the window looking out at the view of Gamla Stan. It was 9 in the morning. All the snow had been washed away by the rain over New Year's.
I've always loved this view, she said. An apartment like this would make me give up living in Saltsjöbaden.
You've got the keys. You can move over from your upper-class reserve any time you want, Blomqvist said.
He closed the suitcase and put it by the front door. Berger turned and gave him a disbelieving look.
You can't be serious, Mikhail, she said. We're in our worst crisis, and you're packing to go and live in Tjotaheti.
Hedestad. A couple of hours by train. And it's not forever.
It might as well be Ulaanbaatar. Don't you see that it will look as if you're slinking off with your tail between your legs?
That's precisely what I'm doing. Besides, I have to do some jail time too.
Krister Malm was sitting on the sofa. He was uncomfortable. It was the first time since they founded Millennium that he had seen Berger and Blomqvist in such disagreement. Over all the years they had been inseparable. Sometimes they had furious clashes, but their arguments were always about business matters, and they would invariably resolve all those issues before they hugged each other and went back to their corners. Or to bed. Last autumn had not been fun, and now it was as if a great gulf had opened up between them. Malm wondered if he was watching the beginning of the end of Millennium.
I don't have a choice, Blomqvist said. We don't have a choice.
He poured himself a coffee and sat at the kitchen table. Berger shook her head and sat down facing him.
What do you think, Krista? She said.
He had been expecting the question and dreading the moment when he would have to take a stand. He was the third partner, but they all knew that it was Blomqvist and Berger who were Millennium. The only time they asked his advice was when they could not agree.
Honestly, Malm said, you both know perfectly well it doesn't matter what I think.
He shut up. He loved making pictures. He loved working with graphics. He had never considered himself an artist, but he knew he was a damned good designer. On the other hand, he was helpless at intrigue and policy decisions. Berger and Blomqvist looked at each other across the table. She was cool and furious. He was thinking hard. "This isn't an argument," Malm thought. "It's a divorce."
"Okay, let me present my case one last time," Blomqvist said. "This does not mean I've given up on Millennium. We've spent too much time working our hearts out for that."
"But now you won't be at the office. Krista and I will have to carry the load. Can't you see that? You're the one marching into self-imposed exile."
"That's the second thing. I need a break, Erica. I'm not functioning anymore. I'm burned out. A paid sabbatical in Hedestad might be exactly what I need."
"The whole thing is idiotic, Mikhail. You might as well take a job in a circus."
"I know. But I'm going to get 2.4 million for sitting on my backside for a year, and I won't be wasting my time. That's the third thing. Round one with Venestrom is over, and he knocked me out. Round two has already started. He's going to try to sink Millennium for good because he knows that the staff here will always know what he's been up to for as long as the magazine exists."
"I know what he's doing. I've seen it in the monthly ad sales figures for the last 6 months.
That's exactly why I have to get out of the office. I'm like a red rag waving at him. He's paranoid as far as I'm concerned. As long as I'm here, he'll just keep on coming. Now we have to prepare ourselves for round three. If we're going to have the slightest chance against Wenestrom, we have to retreat and work out a whole new strategy. We have to find something to hammer him with. That'll be my job this year."
"I understand all that," Berger said. "So go ahead and take a holiday. Go abroad. Lie on a beach for a month. Check out the love life on the Costa Brava. Relax. Go out to Sandhamn and look at the waves."
"And when I come back, nothing will be different. Venestrom is going to crush Millennium, unless he is appeased by my having stood down. You know that. The only thing which might otherwise stop him is if we get something on him that we can use."
"And you think that's what you will find in Hedestad?"
"I checked the cuttings. Venestrom did work at the Wanger Company from 1969 to 1972. He was in management and was responsible for strategic placements. He left in a hurry. Why should we rule out the possibility that Henrik Wanger does have something on him?"
"But if what he did happened 30 years ago, it's going to be hard to prove it today."
"Wanger promised to set out in detail what he knows. He's obsessed with this missing girl. It seems to be the only thing he's interested in. And if this means he has to burn Wenestrom, then I think there's a good chance he'll do it. We certainly can't ignore the opportunity. He's the first person who said he's willing to go on record with evidence against Wenestrom."
"We couldn't use it even if you came back with incontrovertible proof that it was Wenestrom who strangled the girl. Not after so many years. He'd massacre us in court."
"The thought had crossed my mind, but it's no good. He was plugging away at the Stockholm School of Economics and had no connection with the Wanger companies at the time she disappeared." Blomqvist paused.
"Erica, I'm not going to leave Millennium, but it's important for it to look as if I have. You and Krista have to go on running the magazine. If you can, if you have a chance to, arrange a ceasefire with Wenestrom, then do it. You can't do that if I'm still on the editorial board."
"Okay, but it's a rotten situation, and I think you're grasping at straws going to Hedestad."
"Have you a better idea?"
Berger shrugged.
"We ought to start chasing down sources right now, build up the story from the beginning, and do it right this time."
"Ricky, that story is dead as a doornail."
Dejected, Berger rested her head on her hands. When she spoke, at first she did not want to meet Blomqvist's eyes.
"I'm so fucking angry with you. Not because the story you wrote was baseless. I was in on it as much as you were. And not because you're leaving your job as publisher. That's a smart decision in this situation. I can go along with making it look like a schism or a power struggle between you and me. I understand the logic when it's a matter of making Wenestrom believe I'm a harmless bimbo and you're the real threat."
She paused, and now looked him resolutely in the eye.
"But I think you're making a mistake. Wenestrom isn't going to fall for it. He's going to keep on destroying Millennium. The only difference is that starting from today I have to fight him alone, and you know that you're needed more than ever on the editorial board. Okay, I'd love to wage war against Wenestrom, but what makes me so cross is that you're abandoning ship all of a sudden. You're leaving me in the lurch when things are absolutely at their worst ever."
Blomqvist reached across and stroked her hair.
"You're not alone. You've got Krista and the rest of the staff behind you."
"Not Jana Dahlman.
By the way, I think you made a mistake hiring him. He's competent, but he does more harm than good. I don't trust him. He went around looking gleeful about your troubles all autumn. I don't know if he hopes he can take over your role, or whether it's just personal chemistry between him and the rest of the staff.
I'm afraid you're right, Blomqvist said.
So what should I do? Fire him?
Erica, you're editor-in-chief and the senior shareholder of Millennium. If you have to, fire him.
We've never fired anyone, Mika, and now you're dumping this decision on me too. It's no fun anymore going to the office in the morning.
At that point, Mom surprised them by standing up.
If you're going to catch that train, we've got to get moving.
Berger began to protest, but he held up a hand.
Wait, Erica. You asked me what I thought. Well, I think the situation is shitty, but if things are the way Mikhail says, if he's about to hit the wall, then he really does have to leave for his own sake. We owe him that much.
They stared at Malm in astonishment, and he gave Blomqvist an embarrassed look.
You both know that it's you two who are Millennium. I'm a partner, and you've always been fair with me, and I love the magazine and all that, but you could easily replace me with some other art director. But since you asked for my opinion, there, you have it. As far as Dahlman is concerned, I agree with you, and if you want to fire him, Erica, then I'll do it for you, as long as we have a credible reason. Obviously, it's extremely unfortunate that Mikhail's leaving right now, but I don't think we have a choice. Mikhail, I'll drive you to the station. Erica and I will hold the fort until you get back.
What I'm afraid of is that Mikhail won't ever come back, Berger said quietly.
Armansky woke up Salander when he called her at 1:30 in the afternoon.
What's this about?
She said, drunk with sleep. Her mouth tasted like tar.
Mikhail Blomqvist, I just talked to our client, the lawyer Frode.
So?
He called to say that we can drop the investigation of Venestrom.
Drop it? But I've just started working on it.
Frode isn't interested anymore.
Just like that?
He's the one who decides.
We agreed on a fee.
How much time have you put in?
Salander thought about it.
3 full days.
We agreed on a ceiling of 40,000 kronor. I'll write an invoice for 10,000. You'll get half, which is acceptable for 3 days of time wasted. He'll have to pay because he's the one who initiated the whole thing.
What shall I do with the material I've gathered?
Is there anything dramatic?
No.
Frode didn't ask for a report. Put it on the shelf in case he comes back, otherwise you can shred it. I'll have a new job for you next week.
Salander sat for a while holding the telephone after Armansky hung up. She went to her work corner in the living room and looked at the notes she had pinned up on the wall and the papers she had stacked on the desk. What she had managed to collect was mostly press cuttings and articles downloaded from the internet. She took the papers and dropped them in a desk drawer. She frowned. Blomqvist's strange behaviour in the courtroom had presented an interesting challenge, and Salander did not like aborting an assignment once she had started.
People always have secrets. It's just a matter of finding out what they are.
Part 2. Consequence Analyses. January 3rd to March 17th. 46% of the women in Sweden have been subjected to violence by a man. Chapter 8. Friday, January 3rd to Sunday, January 5th. When Blomqvist alighted from his train in Hedestad for the second time, the sky was a pastel blue and the air icy cold. The thermometer on the wall of the station said 0 degrees Fahrenheit. He was wearing unsuitable walking shoes. Unlike on his previous visit, there was no Herr Frode waiting with a warm car. Blomqvist had told them which day he would arrive, but not on which train. He assumed there was a bus to Hedeby, but he did not feel like struggling with 2 heavy suitcases and a shoulder bag, so he crossed the square to the taxi stand. It had snowed massively all along the Norland coast between Christmas and New Year's, and judging by the ridges and piles of snow thrown up by the ploughs, the road teams had been out in full force in Hedestad. The taxi driver, whose name according to his ID posted on the window was Hussein, nodded when Blomqvist asked whether they had been having rough weather. In the broadest Norland accent, he reported that it had been the worst snowstorm in decades, and he bitterly regretted not taking his holiday in Greece over the Christmas period. Blomqvist directed him to Henrik Wanger's newly shoveled courtyard, where he lifted his suitcases onto the cobblestones and watched the taxi head back towards Hedestad. He suddenly felt lonely and uncertain. He heard the door open behind him. Wanger was wrapped up in a heavy fur coat, thick boots, and a cap with ear flaps. Blomqvist was in jeans and a thin leather jacket.
"If you're going to live up here, you need to learn to dress more warmly for this time of year."
They shook hands.
"Are you sure you don't want to stay in the main house? No? Then I think we'd better start getting you settled into your new lodgings."
One of the conditions in his negotiations with Wanger and Dirkfroder had been that he have living quarters where he could do his own housekeeping and come and go as he pleased. Wanger led Blomqvist back along the road towards the bridge, and then turned to open the gate to another newly shovelled courtyard in front of a small timbered house close to the end of the bridge. The house was not locked. They stepped into a modest hallway where Blomqvist, with a sigh of relief, put down his suitcases.
"This is what we call our guest house. It's where we usually put people up who are going to stay for a longer period of time. This was where you and your parents lived in 1963. It's one of the oldest buildings in the village, but it's been modernized. I asked Nilsson, my caretaker, to light the fire this morning."
The house consisted of a large kitchen and two smaller rooms, totalling about 500 square feet. The kitchen took up half the space and was quite modern, with an electric stove and a small refrigerator. Against the wall facing the front door stood an old cast-iron stove in which a fire had indeed been lit earlier in the day.
"You don't need to use the wood stove unless it gets bitterly cold. The firewood bin is there in the hallway, and you'll find a woodshed at the back. The house has been unlived in this autumn. The electric heaters are usually sufficient. Just make sure you don't hang any clothes on them, or it may start a fire."
Blomqvist looked around. Windows faced three different directions, and from the kitchen table he had a view of the bridge, about 100 feet away. The furnishings in the kitchen included three big cupboards, some kitchen chairs, an old bench, and a shelf for newspapers. On top was an issue of C from 1967. In one corner was a smaller table that could be used as a desk. Two narrow doors led to smaller rooms. The one on the right, closest to the outside wall, was hardly more than a cubbyhole with a desk, a chair, and some shelves along the wall. The other room, between the hallway and the little office, was a very small bedroom with a narrow double bed, a bedside table, and a wardrobe. On the walls hung landscape paintings. The furniture and wallpaper in the house were all old and faded, but the place smelled nice and clean. Someone had worked over the floor with a dose of soap. The bedroom had another door to the hallway where a storeroom had been converted into a bathroom with a shower.
"You may have a problem with the water," Wanger said. "We checked it this morning, but the pipes aren't buried very deep, and if this cold hangs on for long, they may freeze. There's a bucket in the hallway, so come up and get water from us if you need to."
"I'll need a telephone," Blomqvist said.
"I've already ordered one. They'll be here to install it the day after tomorrow. So what do you think? If you change your mind, you would be welcome in the main house at any time."
"This will be just fine," Blomqvist said.
"Excellent. We have another hour or so of daylight left. Shall we take a walk so you can familiarise yourself with the village? Might I suggest that you put on some heavy socks and a pair of boots? You'll find them by the front door."
Blomqvist did as he suggested and decided that the very next day he would go shopping for long underwear and a pair of good winter shoes. The old man started the tour by explaining that Blomqvist's neighbour across the road was Gunnar Nielsen, the assistant whom Wanger insisted on calling the caretaker. But Blomqvist soon realised that he was more of a superintendent for all the buildings on Hedeby Island, and he also had responsibility for several buildings in Hedestad.
"His father was Magnus Nielsen, who was my caretaker in the 60s, one of the men who helped out at the accident on the bridge. Magnus is retired and lives in Hedestad. Gunnar lives here with his wife, whose name is Helena. Their children have moved out."
Wanger paused for a moment to shape what he would say next, which was,
"Mikhail, the official explanation for your presence here is that you're going to help me write my autobiography. That will give you an excuse for poking around in all the dark corners and asking questions. The real assignment is strictly between you and me and Dirkfroder."
"I understand. And I'll repeat what I said before. I don't think I'm going to be able to solve the mystery."
"All I ask is that you do your best. but we must be careful what we say in front of anyone else. Gunnar is 56, which means that he was 19 when Harriet disappeared. There's one question that I never got answered. Harriet and Gunnar were good friends, and I think some sort of childish romance went on between them. He was pretty interested in her, at any rate. But on the day she disappeared, he was in Hedestad. He was one of those stranded on the mainland. Because of their relationship, he came under close scrutiny. It was quite unpleasant for him. He was with some friends all day, and he didn't get back here until evening. The police checked his alibi, and it was airtight.
I assume you have a list of everyone who was on the island, and what everybody was doing that day.
That's correct. Shall we go on?
They stopped at the crossroads on the hill, and Vanger pointed down towards the old fishing harbour, now used for small boats.
All the land on Hedeby Island is owned by the Vanger family. Or by me, to be more precise. The one exception is the farmland at Östergården and a few houses here in the village. The cabins down there at the fishing harbour are privately owned, but they're summer cottages and are mostly vacant during the winter. Except for that house farthest away. You can see smoke coming from the chimney.
Blomqvist saw the smoke rising. He was frozen to the bone.
It's a miserable, draughty hovel that functions as living quarters year-round. That's where Eugen Norman lives. He's in his late 70s and is a painter of sorts. I think his work is kitsch, but he is rather well known as a landscape painter. You might call him the obligatory eccentric in the village.
Vanger guided Blomqvist out towards the point, identifying one house after the other. The village consisted of 6 buildings on the west side of the road and 4 on the east. The first house, closest to Blomqvist's guest house and the Vanger estate, belonged to Henrik Vanger's brother Harold. It was a rectangular, 2-story stone building which at first glance seemed unoccupied. The curtains were drawn and the path to the front door had not been cleared. It was covered with 1.5 feet of snow. On second glance, they could see the footprints of someone who had trudged through the snow from the road up to the door.
Harold is a recluse. He and I have never seen eye to eye, apart from our disagreements over the firm. He's a shareholder. We've barely spoken to each other in nearly 60 years. He's 92 now and the only one of my 4 brothers still alive. I'll tell you the details later, but he trained to be a doctor and spent most of his professional life in Uppsala. He moved back to Hedeby when he turned 70. You don't care much for each other, and yet you're neighbours. I find him detestable, and I would have rather he'd stayed in Uppsala, but he owns this house. Do I sound like a scoundrel?
You sound like someone who doesn't much like his brother.
I spent the first 25 years of my life apologising for people like Harold because we're family. Then I discovered that being related is no guarantee of love, and I had few reasons to defend Harold.
The next house belonged to Isabella, Harriet Vanger's mother.
She'll be 75 this year, and she's still as stylish and vain as ever. She's also the only one in the village who talks to Harold, and occasionally visits him. But they don't have much in common.
How is her relationship with Harriet?
Good question. The women have to be included among the suspects. I told you that she mostly left the children to their own devices. I can't be sure, but I think her heart was in the right place. She just wasn't capable of taking responsibility. She and Harriet were never close, but they weren't enemies either. Isabella can be tough, but sometimes she's not all there. You'll see what I mean when you meet her.
Isabella's neighbour was Cecilia Vanger, the daughter of Harold.
She was married once and lived in Hedestad, but she and her husband separated some 20 years ago. I own the house and offered to let her move in. She is a teacher, and in many ways she's the direct opposite of her father. I might add that she and her father speak to each other only when necessary.
How old is she?
Born in 1946. So she was 20 when Harriet disappeared. And yes, she was one of the guests on the island that day. Cecilia may seem flighty, but in fact she's shrewder than most. Don't underestimate her. If anyone's going to ferret out what you're up to, she's the one. I might add that she's one of my relatives for whom I have the highest regard.
Does that mean you don't suspect her?
I wouldn't say that. I want you to ponder the matter without any constraints, regardless of what I think or believe.
The house closest to Cecilia's
was also owned by Hinrich Wanger, but it was leased to an elderly couple formerly part of the management team of the Wanger companies. They had moved to Hedeby Island in the 80s, so they had nothing to do with Harriet's disappearance. The next house was owned by Birger Wanger, Cecilia's brother. The house had been empty for many years since Birger moved to a modern house in Hedestad. Most of the buildings lining the road were solid stone structures from the early 20th century. The last house was of a different type, a modern, architect-designed home built of white brick with black window frames. It was in a beautiful situation, and Blomqvist could see that the view from the top floor must be magnificent, facing the sea to the east and Hedestad to the north.
"This is where Martin lives, Harriet's brother and the Wanger Corporation CEO. The parsonage used to be here, but that building was destroyed by a fire in the 70s, and Martin built this house in 1978, when he took over as CEO.
In the last building on the east side of the road lived Gerda Wanger, widow of Henrik's brother Gregor and her son Alexander.
Gerda is sickly. She suffers from rheumatism. Alexander owns a small share of the Wanger Corporation, but he runs a number of his own businesses, including restaurants. He usually spends a few months each year in Barbados, where he has invested a considerable sum in the tourist trade.